Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Attention all theater lovers, this Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
Hey, listeners, Kevin and I need your help.
Yes, we need your help. Please, please, please. We need your stars.
We need your reviews, you guys, on iTunes so we can start to climb those iTunes rating charts.
It's simple. Open iTunes, click on the iTunes store, search for Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends.
Then click on Ratings and Reviews. Under the Customer Reviews, click Write a Review. Then let us know what you think from 1 to 5 stars.
If you need some help, think of 1 star being Carol Channing and Paul Lynn in the Road Company of the last 5 years, and 5 stars being free front row tickets to Hamilton. Although, when you think about it, I actually would give 5 stars to the Road Company of Carol Channing and Paul Lynn in the last 5 years, because I think that would be awesome.
I would love to hear, can I hear Moving Too Fast as Paul? that's the one I really want.
Jesus Shakes the Goddess. Been through Erica Schwartz and Danica Weiss and the Handelman Twins.
So there you go. You can also leave a comment if you like.
That's it. That's
your reviews.
It.
Send us
Thank
your
you.
Reviews,
Please.
Friends.
Hi, I'm Rob Schneider.
And I'm Kevin David Thomas.
And this is Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Broadway Curtain, and make sure to join our Facebook page at Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends.
And follow us on Instagram at Broadway Curtain Podcast. Plus, you can always listen to our podcasts on Broadway World and Stitcher.
Congratulations for those non-iPhone users.
I don't even know what Stitcher is.
You can now hear our dulcet tones. When we first started this podcast, this guest's name was right at the top of our lists because he is the epitome of a theatrical Renaissance man. As an actor, he appeared in the original West Side Story. As a lyricist, he gave us Annie, I Remember Mama, and 2x2.
And as a director, his award-winning work has been seen not only on stage in such shows as Annie and Cafe Crown, but also on television with the Emmy Award-winning wonderful, marvelous Gershwin.
To tell us what it was like to work with such legends as Jerome Robbins, Judy Holliday, and Dorothy Loudon, plus how he created some of the most memorable moments in musical theater history, here is our idol, Martin Charnin.
Wow. Oh, my. I've never had an introduction like that, ever.
I'm glad we got Cafe Crown in there right off the
yes.
bat. You know,
me too. I loved that show.
It's come up in a lot of our interviews,
really?
Actually. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Walter Bobby, I want to
yeah,
say.
Yeah, we had Walter Bobby.
He took over for David Carroll.
Yeah. Oh, that's because I'm obsessed with David Carroll.
Anytime
I can bring him up to anybody who worked with him or knew him, I always try to hear just, I don't know, a little information about him.
David was a terrific actor. He had, I think, just done Chess.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I think that was the job that he had had. We were at the Public Theater, Joe Papp, and he had always wanted to do Cafe Crown, which was a play from the 40s written by a guy named Highcraft, and revived once and then turned into a musical. Which didn't work, unfortunately. But he brought it to me. I was working with Joe on a couple of projects at the time, and he brought it to me and said, are you interested? Well, being very Hebraic, I agreed immediately. And I said I really wanted to do it with Eli Wallach and Ann Jackson.
Wow.
I had just done a show with them off-Broadway called In Persons, and I brought them into the project. They were dying to do it because they had known the piece. And then I said, well, Joe, I think what we should do is hire as many Yiddish theater actors as we possibly can find who are around. And we got the late, great Feivish Finkel, who just passed away, I think, a couple of weeks ago. I'm not sure, to be that notorious waiter at the Cafe Crown who had all of those great one-liners. That took him an hour to get from stage left to stage right. He shuffled. I mean, we had to slow him down on occasion. Five-ish, you're going too fast. Anyway, he was just brilliant. Bob Dishy was in it.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow.
And David Carroll played the son of Eli and Ann. Well, that was the plot of the piece. But he was basically the only non-Jew in the company. However, he fit in brilliantly. He really took it to heart. And Walter Bobby replaced him.
Yeah.
David then went on to do, I don't know, something else before he, unfortunately.
Grand Hotel.
Yeah. I guess it was Grand Hotel. Maybe.
Before he left us.
Now, right. Growing up in Manhattan, were you exposed a lot to Yiddish theater growing up?
Actually, a lot to Yiddish culture and theater. My father was a singer, and he was a basso profundo at the Met, and he was also a cantor at a congregation on 94th Street.
Now, is it true your dad was not a fan of musical theater?
Loathed it.
Loathed
it.
How did he respond to your getting into it?
Well, truth be told, he really didn't know I got into it on a creative writing side until he had passed away. I was a painter. I went to music and art high school, mm-hmm. Cooper
right.
Union.
Yeah, Cooper Union.
Right.
Yeah.
And I was a pretty good painter, actually, sort of Chagall-y in my...
I love Chagall.
Yeah, in my approach to paint.
Chagall used to say he was Chardonnay.
Oh, so that's... right. I met Chagall once. I did, at the Plaza Hotel. I had an agent at the time named Abe Newborn, who worked for CAA, I think it was, and he took me to lunch at the Plaza, and in the corner table, Chagall had come to New York for an exhibit, I believe. I don't remember. Anyway, Abe spent the entire lunch looking at Chagall and telling me about him, and I knew, of course, a lot about him, but Abe said, we have to get his autograph. I said, okay. I took the menu over to the table. I really didn't have anything else for him to write on. I took the menu over to the table, and he was having lunch with an agent, I think, and his wife. And I took the menu to the table, and I introduced myself, and I introduced Abe Newborn, and I said, in sort of semi-Yiddish, which was the language he really understood.
Yeah.
Basically translated into, could you please sign my menu? And his wife grabbed the pen out of my hand and said, $5,000. And I went, thank you very much. It was a pleasure to meet you. And I left. With my head between my feet, but he didn't do things like that.
That's amazing.
Yeah, evidently,
he wouldn't sign anything.
What a wife, too.
I know. Well,
she was his agent.
Yeah, clearly. She was in the business.
Anyway,
wow.
But anyway, so my father was as I said, a singer at the Met, basso profundo, the C below low C.
Oh yeah.
Right. Ooh. He was great friends with Ezio Pinza.
Oh, yeah.
And when Pinza left the Met to do South Pacific, my father stopped talking to him. He was literally...
I'm picking my jaw up off the floor.
And Pinza was somebody who had dinner at our home, who we knew. And my father just was so angry and upset with him. So I grew up in a culture in which... And why? Because he deserted the high art of the Met, of opera, for the musical theater.
Was your mom an artist as well?
No, my mom was a Jewish homemaker. But my father got ill in about 1955. My father was a perpetual smoker. I mean, I do not have a recollection of him ever not smelling of cigarettes or having one not in his hand. And he smoked shalyapins, which were black Russian cigarettes. They named after Fyodor Shalyapin, who was one of the great bassos of the
yeah.
of the opera world.
That's how you sing solo.
but my father had a heart attack and was bedridden. Mm. And in my last year at Cooper Union, I got a fellowship to go to Guggenheim, to go to Rome to paint, because I was really not bad.
Yeah.
And a friend of mine in the summer that before my last year said, "Well, what are you doing this summer?" And I said, "Nothing. Getting ready for my last year of school." And he said, "Well, why don't you come with me to this adult camp that I'm working at called Timberland in the Adirondacks?" And if anybody ever read Marjorie Morningstar, they would know what those adult camps were like. They were places where people would come for a week or two, but they had a staff, and the staff would be waiting on tables in the daytime and at night be rehearsing for the one-week show that they would put on. And my friend Bobby said to me, "Well, come on, you'll come up, you'll paint sets, and you'll do a walk-on in the Mikado or Damn Yankees or whatever we're doing." And I said, "Okay," I had nothing to do. And I went up there. Really badly bit by... I painted scenery. I did indeed end up in the last year of that summer playing the devil in Damn Yankees.
Nicely done.
You bet. And I just loved it. I really loved it. And I came back and I said to my mother and to my great advisor, "I'm terribly sorry. I cannot go to Rome to paint. I have to give it all up and I have to go into the theater." And they just freaked out, particularly my great advisor, Mrs. O'Sheridan. I still remember her and the look on her face when I told her. And indeed, I kind of just got through my last year and graduated, barely. And a week after I had graduated, there was an ad in the New York Times, a column written by Sam Zolotow, which was called News and Gossip of the Rialto. So the New York Times had a gossip column back in. And the first paragraph said that Jerome Robbins was looking for authentic juvenile delinquents who could sing and act and move a little, and they could all come down to the lobby. Actually, it was the alley of the Broadway Theater on 52nd Street. And they had to come down that day. The audition was at 10 o'clock. And I went, and there were 2,000 people.
Oh, my God.
There were 2,000 people. And Ruthie Mitchell, who was a wonderful stage manager for Hal Prince. Hal was the producer of West Side, which at that time was called Gangway. It wasn't even called West Side. And the show had gone into rehearsal weeks before, but Jerry had not completed the casting of the Jets. And I was there with all these people. I had slicked my hair back, so I kind of looked like James Dean. Uh-huh. And I rolled up my T-shirt and put a pack of cigarettes in it.
Classic.
You had to look like one of the authentic juvenile delinquents. I put on my tightest jeans. I was much skinnier then. And they were all right. My butt was okay, I guess. And lined up with 2,000 other hopefuls of all shapes, sizes, creeds, colors. I mean, it was astonishing, the turnout. And Ruthie would go around going, "Thank you. No, 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 stay. Thank you, no, no, no," and like that. And 2,000 became 200, and I was still there. And ultimately, 200 became 20.
Were they dancing you the whole
time?
They
were doing nothing.
They just literally typecasting.
They were purely and simply typecasting.
Wow.
And I made it to the last 20, and we were brought into the theater. Now, this was a good 3 hours of standing around being pointed at and told you were in or you were out. And the first person I met at the door on my way in was Larry Kurt.
Wow. Tell me.
And he looked at me and he said, "You'll never get it." That was the first thing he said to me. We ultimately became the closest of friends.
Yeah.
And I really mean close, but he was kidding beyond belief, which is what Larry was. And he walked out to go and have his lunch, and I was still there. And the first person who actually auditioned me was Peter Gennaro, who simply asked me to walk from stage left to stage right. We weren't actually on the stage, we were in the lobby. Left to right, and snap my fingers as I walked. And I could do that. And I could do that without licking my finger.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people were licking their fingers in order to make the sound. But I passed the snap test, and boom, I was on. I was there. And the next person I saw was a young man in a shirt and a tie, white shirt and a sort of a black tie, I remember, looking a little bit like what the characters in the Book of Mormon look like right now.
Yeah, totally.
And he made me sing. He said, "Do you have a song?" And I said, "Yeah, I have one song that I really knew, and I knew it because it had four notes in it, and I could really handle those four notes." It was I Wish I Were in Love Again, the Rodgers and Hart thing. I had done it in a variety show that we did up at Timberland at this. And the song is da 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 da. I mean, that was it.
Yeah, totally.
That's the melody of that song, which I had a good lock on. And then, quite simply, the young man said, "Can you do it faster?" So I went, "Okay." And the pianist gave me a new tempo. And it was Daily Fights, Sleepless Nights, Quick to Binary Time, blah, blah, blah. And then he stopped and he said, "Can you do it faster?" And the third time, I really took a deep breath and became very consonant conscious and spit it out. The Daily Fights, the Sleepless, and so on and so forth. I can't do it now. But I did it then. And again, I passed that part of the audition and became one of the 12 that were left from the 20. 8 were cut. I later discovered that it was Sondheim who was asking me to do that and sing quickly. The other faces you kind of knew. Lenny was certainly on from television. You knew Bernstein. You knew Jerry Robbins' face. You didn't really know Steve. There had not been a lot of publicity about him.
New.
I don't know that there were, you know, photographs floating around anywhere.
Yeah.
And that was Sondheim. And the reason, of course, was because ultimately I ended up singing Officer Krupke. And singing Officer Krupke, one needed to have a great command of consonants and whatnot, lyric. And then the next piece of the audition was for, they took us downstairs and a stage manager person gave us a sheet of paper and it was script. It was some part of the script that we were supposed to read. And everybody read the three lines that were underlined. They weren't even highlighted. They were underlined for us to read. And I got a laugh on my reading. Nobody else did. And I thought, oh my God, that's gonna wipe me out. I'm done. And it turned out that that was exactly what Arthur Lawrence, who was conducting that audition, really wanted. And he really wanted it because I ended up being the only Jet who had any jokes in West Side.
And which Jet did you play?
Big Deal.
I played Big Deal.
I was allowed to wear a hat and my glasses, which Jerry loved. And then the last thing was
this is all in one day, by the way.
Oh, yeah, this is one day.
Okay, just making sure.
And then at the end of it all, I met Jerry, who made me walk stage left to stage right and snap. And now I guess he liked my look. And then finally we were taken into another room, and in that other room there was Bernstein. And he made us sing some serious notes. Maria, Because in West Side, there are four voices in the wings doing vocal echoes to Larry singing, Tony singing, mm-hmm. Maria. Mm-hmm. And I'm the third guy on that whatever.
Yeah.
And I then went upstairs and Carl Fisher, who was the general manager, said, sign a contract for $265 and be here tomorrow morning. You go into rehearsal.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
That's how you were cast in West Side Story.
And all the dancing you had to do was walking across the stage and snapping.
Right.
I'm amazed.
One marathon day.
Well,
this is epic.
Jerry was desperate. I mean, he really had two more Jet roles to fill. The other guy who got a part that day was Frank Green, who was the Tony understudy. Mm-hmm. So I got hired and Frank got hired on that day.
Absolutely amazing.
And we went into rehearsal. And then I, of course, had an issue because I couldn't tell my father, who was ill, about the fact that I was in a Broadway musical.
On Broadway, yeah.
I did, however, confide this information to my mother, and between the two of us, we invented this story, which is that I was getting up every morning at 8 o'clock to go downtown to look for a job as a graphic designer or something related to art. And we kept it up until I suddenly realized, oh, goodness, it's July or August or whatever, and we have to go out of town. And how can I explain out-of-town artwork jobs being called for, particularly in Philadelphia and Washington? And I would be gone for 10 weeks, 5 weeks in each town. And so I finally bit the bullet, and I went in, and I told my father, and I sat him down. It was an evening. It was a Sunday night, I remember. And I said, Pop, I got to tell you, I am in a Broadway musical. But listen, everybody who has anything to do with it is Jewish.
It's Bernstein. I mean, like.
And of course, I told him Arthur and Lenny and Steve. And then I told him about Lenny. And Lenny was, of course, the pièce de résistance. I mean, he was in both worlds and legitimately firmly entrenched in both worlds. So it made it all right. My father did write to Lenny while I was on the road and told him, take care of my son or I'll come and get you.
Oh, that's endearing.
That's how I got into the theater.
Wow.
That's how you got in. Now, when you're on stage and you're in the rehearsal process for West Side Story, you have all of these great people at the top of their game around you. Mm-hmm. Are you observing their process?
Totally. As it turned out, the funny thing was that only two people decided to stay at the Jefferson Hotel in Washington. And they were me and Steve. And we had breakfast every morning together. We talk. And I learned an awful lot. And I listened an awful lot to the way that these four giants conducted themselves and what they were doing. But in the final analysis, it was Jerry who had the final say, the directorial say, and who really knew. He knew that show in a way that encouraged me to know everything that I had to know about whatever project I was doing. I couldn't just... isolate something and say, well, I'm the lyric writer and all I care about are how the words are being sung. No, Jerry knew about Sharif's costumes. Jerry knew about Oliver Smith's set. Jerry knew about the orchestrations. Jerry not only knew about the details of whether your pinky was extended properly in the dance hall or not. So the lesson was to learn, listen, and learn. So it was not only a course in how to put a show on, because it was. I mean, there was an immaculateness, if that's a word, mm-hmm. to West Side.
Did the show change a lot in the rehearsal process?
It changed from a blocking standpoint. There were two or three numbers that had preceded me. I didn't take part in them that had been written but were thrown out. But by the time I got into the show, only one new musical number surfaced, and that was Something's Coming, which was written late and was first performed for the Gypsy run-through before we went out of town by Larry on the stage of the Broadway Theater. And to this day, it's one of the great moments. None of us had heard it. None of the cast had heard it. It had been rehearsed in private. And, well, obviously with Steve and with Jerry and whatever, but it was a very private rehearsal because it was only a two-scene, Doc and Tony. And on a stepladder, they lugged out a stepladder in the Gypsy run-through, and he walked up the ladder and sang it. And it was a standing ovation that he got from the audience and from us, who were screaming and yelling. Because imagine hearing Something's Coming for the first time, and only on a piano, only on a piano. And it was still stirring and stunning.
Have you always been into lyric writing? Have you always had a knack for poetry?
Well, I don't think lyric writing and poetry are the same thing. I think lyric writing, if you were a lyric writer, you're writing with a melody in mind. Whether or not that melody ultimately gets used is not the point. But you're writing with cadence, a whole other kind of cadence. You're writing, if you know anything about music, and I knew a little bit about music, you know you're writing couplets or quatrains or whatever you're writing, and you're knowing, poetry does not necessarily have to rhyme. Whereas in my opinion, in this old-fashioned body of mine, I believe that, you know, time and mine don't rhyme. And so I'm a real purist about that, and it bothers me beyond belief today when people get away with rhyming together and forever. They don't rhyme. Right. Mm-hmm. And I think it was even Steve in an article who recently said, not recently, maybe a year ago, I don't know, said that there is something really satisfying with a rhyme that is an honest rhyme, a true rhyme, even if it's a made-up word. And I mean, Yip Harburg was a genius at making up words or having them, you know, cutting something sweet, something sort of grandish, and cutting off the grandish at the ish part or whatever, and making it a word that worked, that rhymed. And I was always a fan of Ogden Nash, so I knew a lot about, and he was a poet, yes, but he was a prankster writing. And I ended up, you know, finding myself very enamored of writing. I in school, I was the editor of a very short-lived magazine called Tom Thumb at Cooper Union. We did a little, I think we had two issues of this humor magazine. That was about it. And I wanted to write lyrics. And I would always write quatrains or couplets to people in responses to their birthdays or to a present I would got. It would be easier to tell them how I felt or what I liked or disliked or what I thought about in four lines that rhymes. Do you still figured if the intention wasn't there, at least the service that I attended in terms of doing it, turning it into a little poem was, do I still? Oh, it's the only way I answer letters.
Say, you'd be great at Twitter. I mean, Twitter's perfect for him.
We should put you on Twitter.
Now, you did a lot of review work, and you still continue to do a lot of review work. How does your work in crafting a review shape how you're going to write or direct a piece of musical theater?
They're totally different. Mm. And at the same time, they're exactly alike. I mean, exactly the same. It's a question of structure. It's a question of sequencing. It's a question of you don't put three ballads necessarily in a row, one right after another. Review, you can get away with murder in a review because basically in a review for the 3 minutes that the... And I'm talking really about old-fashioned reviews. I'm not talking about what things are now being called reviews, which are the jukebox musical kind of things. Because in point of fact, you could have done Jersey Boys by just doing Frankie Valli. But they interpolate... I mean, same thing with Mamma Mia. They made the songs theoretically fit the script, so there is a continuity and a structure there. But in the reviews that we were doing early on, like at Julius Monk,
mm-hmm.
Who was a master of putting these little cabaret shows together on a place called Upstairs at the Downstairs. And I did three reviews with him. And there were wonderful performers who were doing my material. Kay Ballard and did a couple of things that I wrote, and Marsha Lewis, mm-hmm. and Charles Nelson Reilly.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, these were all people who worked. We were all beginners. My first review that I ever had done was done in Provincetown before Julius, had Ruth Buzzy, Dom DeLuise, and Charles Nelson Reilly. And they were, you know... They didn't exist.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we did a show, and then I did a review in the last year that I was in West Side. I decided to stay in West Side for 1,000 performances, which I did.
1,000.
I closed for one. I did 1,000 performances on Broadway, and then we went out on the road and we came back. So I played West Side for 1,000 performances, and then left and. Oh, I did get another job as a writer, as a lyricist, in a show called The Girls Against the Boys.
Mm-hmm.
But that was all a weird kind of thing.
Bert Lahr and Nancy Walker.
I was hired, actually, to be the guy who did rewrites on the funny numbers that weren't getting laughs for Bert Lahr and for Nancy Walker.
How did you get that job?
It was very complicated, and they said, we really can't hire you that way, so what if we put you in the show and call you Dick Van Dyke's understudy?
We were curious how you got to be Dick Van Dyke's standby.
Well, I was Dick Van Dyke's standby. I never went on. I don't know if I ever saw any of the show, because what I was doing was writing lines that for Bert Lahr and Nancy Walker for songs that ultimately ended up in the show. I mean, it didn't work. It wasn't necessarily a good idea or a funny idea, but that was how I got into it.
But good practice, too.
Yeah.
I mean, to have to deal with a personality like that and find his comedy for him.
Right.
Now, wow.
I have to ask you about a musical of yours that I don't know anybody has ever seen, which is inspired by a Life magazine article?
Yeah, that was a show. The first person that I really had a serious collaboration with was Mary Rodgers.
Once Upon a Mattress.
Yeah,
and
she had done Once Upon a Mattress. I didn't do Once Upon a Mattress, but she did it.
She did it.
She wrote
Marshall
it.
Marshall Barham.
And with Marshall, mm-hmm. right, who is a genius, was a genius writer, lyric writer. Crazy, but a genius.
Yeah, it goes hand in hand.
I met Mary through her connection to Steve. I mean, they were close friends.
Famously.
And I was brought into that community because I guess I was presentable and funny. I don't know. but the point is that Mary and I began to write. The first thing that we wrote was this musical. She had found an article in Life magazine. There was a credit card back in the 60s called Carte Blanche.
Carte Blanche.
The Carte Blanche card. Oh, yeah. Well, it existed. It was one of the first, if not the first.
Okay.
And a guy, some guy, a young man of about, I don't know, 20, 25, stole a card and charged about $100,000 worth of equipment, of things. I don't know what you steal, what they were specifically, but they were things, stereo sets, television sets, whatever. And an article appeared in Life magazine with him sitting on top of this mountain of stuff that he had bought with the fake, with the stolen credit card. And he had this incredibly self-satisfying look on his face, a big grin from ear to ear. And the caption was, "Why is this man smiling?" And then you find out that Life magazine, in order to get his story, paid off his debt to the credit card company.
Oh my
and
God.
Mary thought that was a really neat idea for a musical.
Yeah,
and we were writing at the time, and she and I began to work on it. And we took the idea to Hal Prince and Bobby Griffith, who was his partner at the time, and George Abbott. And they loved it. And they said, "Okay, guys, write it, and we will do it." So we began to write it. We wrote a part for Tony Perkins, Psycho Tony Perkins.
Oh, yeah, of
to
course.
Play, to
Green
play
Willow Tony Perkins.
Green Willow Tony Perkins. No, you're right. Just to prove that he could sing. Yeah. So we were able to, and because of her connection to Mattress, Mary got Carol Burnett to agree to be the female lead in the thing. So we had a really neat package. Burnett, Perkins, Griffith and Prince,
yeah.
George Abbott, and Bobby passed away. Bobby died of a heart attack, and the whole thing fell apart. The entire thing. We'd written four songs for it by the time when that had happened. Four of them ended up in Hotspot. So, I mean...
Your next collaboration.
Which was the next thing that I did with... No, it wasn't the next thing I did with Mary. Next thing I did with Mary was a show for television, one of the first original musicals for television called Feathertop.
Yeah.
Based on a Nathaniel Hawthorne short story for the Halloween of, I don't know, 1962.
Yeah.
What makes Mary Rodgers so good?
Oh, Mary had the world's greatest sense of humor. She was so and she was bright beyond belief. And also, here was a girl, and ultimately a woman, who was surrounded by... Let us face it, folks. I mean, if you turn to the left, there's Oscar Hammerstein. If you turn to the right, there's your father sitting at the piano. And it was Richard Rodgers. It wasn't just some guy sitting at the piano plunking away heart and soul.
Yeah.
So she learned a lot from him. Ultimately, she didn't want to write anything like him. But she was clever and she was witty. And she was funny, and she had a very sharp sense of humor. And everything made Mary laugh. Everything made Mary laugh. You could just simply say, "I saw a guy walking down the street." And before you finished the sentence, she was on the floor laughing. She was great. We wrote a television show together with Woody Allen as the sketch writer that never got on the air, interestingly enough, for the U.S. Steel Hour. And then we wrote Feathertop, and then we wrote Hotspot.
That is so cool. Now tell us about Hotspot, which is a show that not a lot of people know, and it's one of the things that we'd like to expose our students to.
I mean, Judy Holliday, hello.
Yeah.
Well, why is it that there's a story about everything? Is that how it is with everybody you've talked to?
Yeah, there is, and we love it.
But you're drilling in weirdly... uncharted territory.
Join us next week for part two of our interview with Martin Charnin.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical, Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Suffs has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard. So you were being crucified over here, but
yeah,
not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.